where you can download them and listen to them at your leisure later, or if you've missed one. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Andy Couturier, bowing to you as we speak.
Humbly
bowing to you as we speak. Mr. Couturier is the author of this lovely book, A Different Kind of Luxury, Japanese Lessons in Simple Living and Inner Abundance. He has had a wide array of experiences in Japan and elsewhere, Japan for 4 years. He lives now in the Bay Area, I believe Santa Cruz area, if I'm not mistaken. And we're delighted that he has been able to make it up here tonight, all the way from far Santa Cruz. Thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers.
Hi, good evening. Before I start, let's all give thanks for small independent bookstores. whatever way you can find to support your small independent bookstore so that they can keep providing space for us and doing events and paying their rent, that's more important than you can know. I'm also very honored to have one of the people who has contributed a piece of art for the book here tonight. Deirdre Bailey drew the map for the book, and you'll see it right before the color section if you haven't looked at it, and I'm really grateful to her. And she didn't know I was going to call her name out. Deirdre and I went to high school together. okay, so I'm going to start. And you're going to meet some great individuals. Every time I prepare a talk, I sort of look through the book, and I've spent some time reading this book, and I just continue to be nourished by the people and find their stories again and again, really continue to deepen. So if you haven't taken a look at it yet, and you do get a chance to read it slowly, and if you have looked at it, perhaps you'll share in my joy of rereading it. All right. So I'm going to start with this word. Time. So time. Time for what really matters in our lives. If you're at all like me, you're sort of very scheduled up. You got lots of things to do and people calling you. And there's a lot of theories and suppositions as to why we got over busy in the first place, but whatever the cause, one of the results is it gives us very little time to contemplate and to sort of think about sort of the larger questions. Dare I say it, why are we here? I picked the 11 people in this book out of the many people I met in Japan because I thought they were very different from each other, but also each of them really great examples of how to live a meaningful and important life. They're not the only way, but I thought they had a lot to teach me, and that's what sort of started me out writing the book and wanting to share that with others. It's actually took me 20 years, and it's been published for 3 months, so it's really took a lot of actual time, sort of going through the Japanese, translating it, and if I got even a fraction of it into the English, I hope, I think it'll be valuable to others. And before I start showing you some slides, I just thought I'd say about time that one of the things I learned from these folks is that having time requires not just sort of a general setting up your life that you have time, but your days, the actual sort of day-to-day plan of your existence, and I've learned that from them. Okay, let me bring you to a little bit of an unexpected place, as long as the great gods of technological, the deities here will cooperate. So, the technological deities. Let's see.
The drain is what makes the stuff run.
Well, they like us to abase ourselves to them. The people you're going to meet in this book do live in rural areas, and I wanted to just start with this image. This is not a rural area. This is Shinjuku Station. How many people have been to Japan? Okay, so Japan is the same size as California. It has 130 million people as compared to roughly 30 million people in the United States. So think about crowded. The Tokyo metropolitan area has 30 million people. That's the United States, California. Thank you. California, same size as Japan, 30 million in California and 130 million in Japan. So 2 million people a day pass through Shinjuku Station. The people you'll meet in this book don't live this way, but most people in Japan do, and that's sort of an important thing I like to stress before I talk about this. In this picture, just the moment before I took it, every single person in this line was looking at their cell phone. They didn't cooperate by continuing to do it for the photograph. I got on the train, and I took this picture. This is of a junior high school student, and she is fallen asleep while texting. And she's got her little, you know, caffeine dispensing device, her Lipton tea there. But I think, you know, it's sort of a bit of a funny picture, but as I looked at this picture, I realized how different is she than all of us. You know, we're sort of like overtaxed and overtired and still, you know, wanting a little bit more stimulation or a little bit more connection. And it's an addiction that's pretty profound. This is Kyoto, the ancient capital of Japan. It's not the pictures you're used to seeing of Kyoto. Kyoto is the only city in Japan that was not bombed by the Americans, and it looks very much, most of it looks very much like the rest of Japan. So most of it, the old wooden buildings have been razed, and this is a parking garage, a machine for producing income on investment. And now we're on the train. We're just looking at the way the majority of people in Japan, can everyone see, live. This most of it happened in the past 50 years. Millions of people moved from rural areas into the city to take part in the Nikon, Toyota, Hitachi, Honda, Kawasaki, all of these brand names you're familiar with. It's a country with almost no natural resources, and it's the second largest economy in Japan. That has happened almost entirely out of people's time, by working very hard and, you know, intelligently, and, you know, and I drive a Japanese car, so I don't want to in any way besmirch the people who've produced that for us, but one of the byproducts is what you're seeing here. I won't do this to you too much longer. We're about 3.5 hours outside of Tokyo here in the Japan Alps of Nagano Prefecture, where 3 of the 11 people in this book live. These are the rice paddies getting ready for, or being prepared for, planting. This is a sunset in the mountains. And now we're in another rural area. This is Shikoku. This is the smallest of the 4 main islands, and another 5 live in this part of Japan. This is right around the rice harvest here, and this is the village of Kamikatsu. We're really, Michael, can I tilt that just slightly so we're not running off there? Great. Okay, I love this place. I'm going to introduce you to about 4 or 5 people in depth here tonight. And the first one lives in this old farmhouse, which has been lovingly restored by them. It was abandoned. Many of the people in this village have moved. It used to be 50 years ago, there were 9,000 people living in the village of Kamikatsu, and now there are 3,000. Most of those houses are now empty or have just a few old people living in it. So very few younger people are moving in. This is Atsuko Watanabe, quite an extraordinary human being, and somebody who definitely confound your stereotype of the shy and retiring Japanese woman. The very first time I met her, she confronted me. The very first thing she said to me, she says, what kind of environmentalist are you if you're working for this pharmaceutical company teaching English? And I was quite taken aback. I was just, oh, I'm just teaching English. But I loved her immediately for that. This is where much of the book, many of the interviews were translated, many of the interviews with her and her partner were made. This is just sort of a little bit of an ambience of her house. She has no television. She grows most of her own food. She cooks on a wood stove that she uses old pieces of kindling that have been, well, she wouldn't call it kindling, they're scraps from the local lumber mill that are delivered. You know, the lumber mill probably thinks they're taking their garbage, but they heat their house entirely, and it's quite cold. They do all their cooking, almost all their cooking, on this old Nepali cook stove, and this is her sorting the firewood that sort of, this is, many people ask about this. This is a mosquito net that she's wearing on her hat, and right here she's sorting the firewood and turning it over. It's very rainy in the village of Kamikatsu, and I noticed one day she and her partner Gufu were turning over the firewood. It had gotten wet, so that it, and it was a dry, sunny day, and they were putting it out to just turning over each individual piece. And I thought, oh, I really love this traditional style life they're living, and it's so rustic, but that's really a lot of tedious work. So I eventually just screwed up my nerve to ask her about it, and she's like, well, while I'm doing this, at least my spirit is free. I'm not being told to work by someone else. And that was one of the first things I learned from her. Here she is doing some cooking. I'm going to read you a few excerpts from the book. And this is chapter 3. And she says, so I asked her, when did her life change? And she said, primarily when she went overseas. She went traveling. Her first country was Afghanistan. And I said, why'd you go there? She said, oh, someone asked me. Some of the other girls in school were going, and they needed a fourth person. And I thought, well, why not? I'll go along with her. Here's a little excerpt from the book. Something else happened to her overseas, she says. So she moved from Afghanistan to Pakistan to Nepal to India. In India, traveling alone, I had a lot of time to just sit and think and to wonder about the reasons that I'm here on this earth. At the same time, I saw the Indians spend a lot of time in temples, working to improve their souls, to move up when they go on to the next life. It's clear to me that spirituality was absolutely central to their lives in the way it isn't here for us in Japan. I started to give a lot of thought to what the purpose of being alive actually is. Many Japanese people don't have the opportunity, she pauses, don't make an opportunity to think deeply about things for an extended period of time. Maybe that's why many of them aren't satisfied with their lives. And I tell in the chapter a little bit about her progression. She grew up as the daughter of a doctor, and she thought all that religious God stuff was bogus. And there's a whole journey that she goes through, which I detail in the book. This is some of her pottery. For their modest income, her partner Gufu throws pots, and she does most of the painting. You'll see some of his work later. Can you see there? Mm-hmm. She has a real range of styles. So this is sort of a European influenced with some of the local moths. And I should say that the lushness of the Japanese countryside can really hardly be exaggerated. Even just moths, not talking about butterflies, are incredibly beautifully colored and quite a variety of them. So I asked her during one of the interviews about, you know, wouldn't you think other people would love to do this life if they only knew how much fun it could be? And she contradicts me immediately. She said, I didn't choose this life because of the fun. It's, you know, that's a totally modern concept to be oriented towards enjoyment. That in modern times, in our society, you know, we just do things that we find enjoyable, and as soon as it stops being enjoyable, we stop doing it. that's a totally modern concept. And I, she says, now we need everything to be entertaining. So I say, so do you think people today have gotten more greedy? It's not, she replies, it's not that the greed has changed since long ago, but that the chance to actually get these things, to satisfy our greed, has increased, so that many, many people are able to do so. And as a result, people have begun to pursue their greed avidly and to chase after it. A long time ago, people didn't have a chance to own cars or to win prizes for their art. That was only for a few. Now everyone wants that. But there's no need for that kind of desire. After a moment of consideration, she says, what I really want is more time. I look up at the clock. We've been talking for 4 hours now. I think about how difficult it is for most of my English students to even give an hour a week to an English class. And I think, you know, how insanely busy people are here. Then Atsuko adds, long ago, people probably didn't have time either. And I imagine rural life of 2 centuries ago and peasants struggling all day long just to provide enough to survive. She says, they were really busy. They couldn't realistically expect to seek having more things or time. Now, as long as you don't desire too many things, you can have some time. I say, but Atsuko, you have a lot to do as well, thinking of her time weeding or hand-peeling chestnuts or cooking or doing her environmental work. I do, but while I'm doing them, my spirit is free. No one is telling me work. All right. I'm going to move on to her partner, Gufu. Gufu Watanabe. His name is a name that he took on himself, and it's actually one of the few words in Japanese that has a similar feeling and meaning. It means crazy wind. So it sounds... very similar in Japanese and English. And he's taken it on so that he doesn't... so it reminds him not to feel too self-important. He's quite a botanist, and let me just read you a little bit about his garden here. So this is from the very beginning of the chapter on Gufu, chapter 8. I've never seen a flower like this one before. It's milky white, huge and translucent, glowing like a moon in the last of the day's light. And the fragrance, kind of beguiling, sumptuous smell, but fleeting. A relative of the morning glory, Gufu says to me as he holds it away from the bamboo trellis, but it only blooms at dusk. It's quite rare outside of Japan. The paper-thin blossom is almost the size of a person's head, and you can tell it's the kind that won't last for more than a few hours. And this one's also interesting, he continues, bending down. It's called Torikabuto in Japanese and monkshood in English. And then he goes on and tells me the Latin term and how they call it in Nepali, and then for some of them he knows the Hindi but not the Nepali, and some he knows the Nepali. It's quite poisonous, and in the past was used on the tips of arrows. There was an incident several years ago, he laughs nervously, when a woman killed her husband by feeding him some monkshood in order to get his life insurance money. It's known as the Torikabuto murder incident. If you use regular poison, it's easy to detect, but a green plant, well... So we walk through, and he tells me about goosefoot or wild spinach, and talks to me about sort of cultural history of each of these plants. This is the Cherokee Trail of Tears, and here's the Korean chili pepper, and here's the sugar potato root. It's from this part of the Andes. You can boil it with soy sauce. And he shows me this bush bean that has these bizarre square-shaped pods, and it's from Okinawa. And I've been through his garden dozens of times, and I rarely meet the same plant twice. And then we go in the chapter, we go into dinner, and he starts telling me about sculpture in Afghanistan, and the Buddha's head has these curly hairs, and that's actually from Apollo because of Alexander the Great coming in the 3rd century. And I'm thinking, how does he know so much? And I think that really has to do with his relationship to time. And that, after a lot of thinking, I realized had to do with his relationship to money. These are his chili peppers. He's quite an aficionado of dozens of kinds of chili peppers. Quite unusual in Japan. So Let me read you a little bit. So when he, they also, many of these people lived in India for a long time, which I also found very surprising when I first met them. Let me read you a little portion about him being in India. From some conversations I've overheard between Gufu and his friends, I imagine they might even have been competing with each other to see how little they could live on. Gufu harvested sugarcane. I don't know if anyone here has done that kind of labor, but of manual labor, it's pretty much some of the toughest manual labor you can do. So I can imagine when he got to India, he was pretty uninterested in wasting his money. He stayed in the dingiest hotels, bedbug infested or not, and took the cheapest Indian public buses. I don't know if anyone done that, but these are like authentic experiences in overcrowding noise, continuous jolts to the body as the roaring diesel-powered box of welded steel plates hit pothole after pothole at whatever speed a young Indian driver can get away with. Gufu says, I got into the habit of not having much and not needing much. I didn't have an ideology of not spending money in India. I just wanted to be there a long time. And I didn't have much money. And I say, there's a term in Japanese called bimbo ryoko. Bimbo means sort of poor or poverty, and ryoko is travel. Bimbo ryoko. And I said, whether bimbo ryoko was a way of traveling that Gufu and other young Japanese travelers then did out of necessity or choice, one thing is certain, it allowed them to have a lot of time. When people say time is money, they're usually admonishing you not to waste your time, because then you'd be losing money. But of course, the inverse is true. Gufu had a lot of time because he didn't waste money. Time is what we have in this life, and how we use it determines what our life is. Why is it that so many people start to value money so much that they trade in most of the hours and years of their life in order to get it?
Did you take all the photos?
Most of the photos are mine, but the best ones are not. This one is not. This is some of his travel journals. This is what he did, just writing down everything. You can see that there's English lettering, that there's Devanagari script, and that he's glued in receipts from bus transfers and tickets on ferries across the Ganges. This is a really sort of quintessential Gufu picture. He really sort of likes the weird and odd. He grows guava in his garden, even in cold climate. You see that he's written down the price, for all of you who Nepali readers here, the price he paid in rupees for potatoes and onions. A lot of cooking scenes predominate in his journals. This is a chart of different kinds of Indian sweets with little notations on, you know, their crunchiness or fluffiness. As any of you who've had Japanese food know, Japanese food in general is pretty delicious, but the food I had with these folks is really unique. So there's lots of, you know, tea stalls or the layout of the different Thali dishes that he ordered, you know, notated, of course. He said that sometimes the food would get cold before he finished drawing. And I sort of delicately said, well, that's sort of too bad, you know, the food got cold. And he said, oh, it's no problem at all. You know, once I'd gotten it down, I could make it any time. And in fact, he has not been back to India for almost 25 years now. And every time I visit him, there's some different dish. You know, this is from this particular valley in Nepal, they don't spice it this way in other places. So because he slowed down and took these great notes and really delved into his travel and spent a long time there, he was able to let it enrich him for the rest of his life. This is all different things. And he's a potter, so he, you know, drew all of these different containers, a mixing bowl, a milking pot, a butter bowl, an eating bowl. Let's see. This is some of his pottery that he's illustrated. He's very inspired by the art of Indian tribal minorities. And which I didn't even know that there were sort of different art of these tribes in Orissa. These are donation jars for a UNICEF concert that someone asked him to make these jars, and he said, well, I wonder if people would donate more if the container was strange. And there's some great stuff in the book about his theory of art and drawing a flavorful line. And this, he says, I call this drink tea then go. This one's a Tibetan monk, although he's in Bali here. Kind of strange that he's a Tibetan in Bali. So he's, even though it's out of his deeply mulched imagination. See, he's offering tea. Yes, you can go, but first, stop, have a cup of tea. Drink tea, then go. It's a Zen proverb. Most Japanese people today wouldn't understand it. This is a chameleon. This is his pottery studio. You would have to work hard to find a showroom that is less publicized. There's no sign saying Watanabe's pottery this way. There's prices on everything. He's not opposed to selling it, but he feels like if you orient your mind as the artist towards, I'm going to sell this thing, that something gets off in your heart and mind, and it affects the way the art comes out. We're drinking tea here, and I noticed one day that there was this yellow spiral-bound journal where he had these lists in it, and I asked if I could look at it, and the names of all of these different flowers and plants, and he doesn't do too many ornamentals. He doesn't do too many. Let's back up. Hatsuko, his partner, sort of criticized him. Shouldn't we do a little bit more things we could eat? And he's like, yeah, well, enough, but I'm sort of interested in the collecting of fragrances. And so he's, so Hatsuko is more of a native plant type person, but he's really into interesting plants from all over the world. So in this journal, he's written down every year for 15 years the date that each of these flowers bloom, and he's kind of watched them over the years. And he said, and one winter, it was very cold, and everything bloomed 15 days later. And then about 3 or 4 weeks in, everything went back to its previously established patterns. Very curious, very interesting. And I actually wrote a little article about him in Adbusters, and in that I said, you know, here's this person who with almost no investment has had this really rich interaction with the natural world. Not some idea of connecting with nature, but really seeing the actual rhythms of nature just by means of his spiral-bound notebook and watching. And this is carrot halva that he's serving you. All right, let me bring you to another place. This is the house of Mr. Kogan Murata. He's a bamboo flute player. Probably some of you are familiar with the term shakuhachi. Shakuhachi is actually not all bamboo flutes. It actually refers to the length of bamboo flute. Murata-san plays the kyotaku, which is much longer, sort of has a deeper tone, and as opposed to being for tunes or musical entertainment, it's more a tool of meditation. So if you meet him first as a flute player, you hear these deep, sonorous, old tunes, 7 to 12 centuries old, all of them really rich and resonant, talking, you know, you can even feel the sort of emptiness and impermanence in the sound, and you think, oh, this is a very solemn person, but he's actually incredibly energetic human being, which, you know, really sort of broke my stereotype of the Zen practitioner. And he says, you know, the real thing, we're always looking for the real sound as a bamboo flute player. And you can't find that in 1 or 2 years. 10 years is not enough. 20 years is not enough. 30 years, maybe that's not even enough to just keep playing and playing. And I think that's another sort of lesson I pulled from these folks. Another man said, he was reading Thoreau's Walden. I was like, oh yeah, right. And he says, yeah, I liked it okay, but it should have been more about food. And he only stayed there for 2 or 3 years. Seems he was like more of a tourist. You need at least 10 years to really understand a way of life. All right, so read you a few of Murata-san's words here. So he takes me out into the rice paddy. This is the tool he's using to draw the lines in the mud. And he says, come on, Andy, you know, help us out with it. And I said, oh, you know, I'm not really very good at this. I know how clumsy I am, and I'm like, you know, I'm going to mess it up, the Japanese straight lines. And so I protest. I know nothing about rice planting. He insists that I try. And so with my bare feet in the warm mud, I make my way along the lines he has scored just below the water. I've rarely felt more clumsy, but Murata is relentlessly encouraging, calling out, all okay, no problem. After I've put in 20 or 30 feet of a drunken-looking line of tiny green plants, I ask him, is this really okay? Do it any way you like. He shouts across the plateau of muck. And then, fearing that I'm rushing, he calls out, slothfully, slothfully. I'm not immediately sure of the meaning of the word he's using, chintara chintara, but I deduce the meaning from his explanatory gestures. It's like this. He juts his head way forward, his eyelids half closed, and takes plodding small steps. He exaggerates the movement more, laughing, trying to look like the character of a lazy slob. Chintara chintara. It's almost a mantra for him. Lazily, dawdling, go slower. Sluggish, don't hurry, rest more, take a break. This is his partner, Sayaka. I wanted to interview her. Sayaka-san, might I bother you too much to, you know, trying to use my polite Japanese to humble myself? And could I interview you? She said, let's have some tea. So even I was not too dense to understand the meaning of her reply. This is their son, Kohei. Kohei is like really the quintessential young boy, and you don't really meet, especially in Japan, you know, with all the sort of video games, boys like this anymore. When I first got there, he nailed me with this squirt gun made of bamboo. And he's running around in the mud fields, playing, falling over in the mud, shrieking, and he really has a boyhood in nature that I found very inspiring. And they live on $3,500 a year, all of the three of them.
Do they grow the rice for themselves or for sale?
That's a great question. Do they grow the rice for themselves or for sale? Let me read you the passage on this. This makes me wonder about the economics of Murata's rice farming. We sit now in the shade of the tree, drinking some cool roasted barley tea that he has brought in stainless steel thermos. I ask him how much his rice fields produce. Now that we're talking numbers, I start to understand the potential for what he could be making but isn't. Each year, he says he grows about 1,400 pounds of rice. Considering the three small fields we're looking at, that seems like a lot. He doesn't, however, technically sell it, he says. The arrangement, as best as I can understand it, is that besides the 200 or 300 pounds of rice Murata and his family eat in a year, there are four or five families that receive his rice. It's half gift, kind of barter, Murata says. The families give him the equivalent of about $1.80 a pound. About $1 a pound cheaper than the going rate for organic rice in Japan. The families, all friends, help him out in kind. With some clothes or something, he says. For me, that's enough. And this is me. And what if, I ask, kind of embarrassed to be so business-minded, they didn't want to buy from you? Would you go to the organic cooperative to sell it? I don't do things like that. I only sell to friends. I tilt my head in question. As soon as I go to the cooperative, he says with a frown, it's just money talk. Only, I would be in business then. I'm not interested in that. Soon everyone's talking about making money. His voice lets me know how unpleasant this is to him. And I'd also have to sign a contract with them and keep producing it. It gets like this. He grabs an imaginary rope around his throat, almost like a necktie. Choking his head sideways as if being hung from a noose. In English, he lets out a cry, choking me! The way I do it now, I'm completely free. Those families I sell to could tell me that they don't want to buy my rice anymore, and I could also stop selling. That's the best relationship, I've come to believe. So here he's comparing the rice grown by his neighbor. He's saying this rice here is sort of yellowed and sickly and weak, but he, you know, grows it for planting with a machine, and that he plants them early and uses a lot of chemicals and fertilizers to make up for the weakness. But his, he plants very few and late and spaces them apart. So he can't grow as much, but in the end, they end up coming out even because he doesn't have. But he says, but I have time, so I can do it slowly. So, let's see. Maybe just a couple of pictures of him talking to me. So, very different from the sort of severe bamboo flute player. Let's meet another person. This is in southern Kochi Prefecture, which is on the island of Shikoku. Very rainy area. I'm going to introduce you to a family here. This is Ms. Asha Amemiya. She is quite a tough customer. This was a difficult chapter to write. She would say things to me like, why are you asking us all these questions? What kind of book are you going to write anyway? And so I try to defend myself. Oh, well, I just think, you know. And she's pretty hard-edged, but really, I don't want to reduce it to a cliche, but she's really a powerful person with a real deep sense of beauty as well. So I start the chapter on her saying, if you don't have a whole lot of unsatisfied people, the economy stops dead, doesn't it? And then the entire society is in trouble. It's like, what do you mean? She's like, well, for example, a good computer comes out, and people say, hey, that's a good thing and convenient and useful. And they buy it, right? And they're satisfied for a time. Then a new one comes out, a new variety, and there's all kinds of improvements, right? So, of course, you want it. The one that you've been using, the one you've been thinking, huh, this is really good. Well, the next one is even better. Since you want it, you have to work even more. She sort of nods her head. It takes money to buy it, doesn't it? But if you keep chasing that kind of thing, there's no end to it. Next, 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 next. The better one, the better one, the even better one. A lot of people think if they start out down that road, there's definitely going to be a good thing at the end of it. And somewhere there's a point where they'll be satisfied. They don't understand that it's never ending. Once you start heading down that road, it gets faster and faster, and you have to go along with that pace. But to me, enough. It's a pain in the ass. What is it you say, pointing to me? Pugyol. Oh, that's Bengali, isn't it? Oh, wait a minute, is that Nepali? It's what you say when your stomach is totally full. That's enough. I don't need any more. Too many people say, it's good enough just as it is. Then the system. What is it you call it? Capitalism. Stops turning. And like I said, it's a big problem. So we sort of examine that question throughout the chapter. This is her house, sort of tucked in to the green forest back here. It's, of all the houses I went to, it's the least likely to be featured in a book of rural chic. The shoji are sort of torn from the cats jumping at the moths on the other side of it. There's a like post across here, very low, kind of about this level. I stayed there and discovered its height. But the things that are important to her, she rivets them down like a rivet on a battleship. So all her food is safe. Her kids have time with her. With her partner also is really connected. So they actually have a relationship with their father, which is pretty unusual in Japan. Song and music is a big part of their lives. This is Himali, the oldest girl, and she is now in Osaka. So I interview her in the book and ask her opinions of growing up this way, and it's quite interesting, her thoughts on it. And I actually just got a letter from her saying I sort of changed my opinions a little bit from what I said in the book. So she's sort of a little down on it, but I think she's sort of, perhaps even by like reading this book, she said, opening up to what it is her parents actually gave her. This is a book of poems by Tagore. Do people know who Tagore is? Mm-hmm. He's the first Asian to win the Nobel Peace Prize in Literature Prize in 1916. And he founded a university, and they lived there in Bengal for 10 years. So when I first got there, all the girls are chatting to each other in Bengali. And imagine going like 8 to 10 hours by fast train outside of Osaka and having little girls chatting to each other in Bengali. And later on this evening, Himali does an Indian classical dance, Bengali dance for us. This is her sister Shanti, who has a little speaking part. Really incredible kids. I mean, that's one of the things I learned also, just how if you have a life with a lot of time and really connect to your children, they turn out pretty damn awesome. This is some of the artwork that Amemiya has. I actually brought some original pieces of artwork of some of the people in the book to share with you guys tonight. So I'll pass this around later. Can people tell that this is actually Bengali script here? This is a poem translated from the Bengali to Japanese by Tagore, and then she's made this artwork. And she talks a fair amount about the cultivation of sentiments, and there's sort of an implicit or explicit critique of the Japanese education system. Let me read you a little bit more from the chapter about her. It's summer again, and I'm visiting Amemiya and Yamashita's house, and again the insects are loud. Just finishing lunch, cooked cucumbers in a creamy broth. I would never have thought of something like this, but it's fantastic. She's made do with what's in season, minus what they weren't able to grow successfully this year, which this season, she tells me, was quite a bit. Almost all the corn was eaten by crows, and there was a blight on the tomatoes. I ask her, so what vegetables do you have? Cucumbers, green onions, carrots, green peppers, leeks, potatoes, she says. And the eggplants are coming in a week or two. You can hear the delight in her voice. And I said to her, don't you sometimes have the desire to just go by the store and pick up some eggplant? I saw them here on the way here in big bags and cheap. That would be bad mannered, she exclaims. And then more softly, her flowers on the eggplant bush, the delight of seeing those pretty light purple flowers audible in her voice. And soon we'll have eggplants. It would be rude to the eggplants, just ugly, to go out and buy them, don't you think? I love this picture of her. She's not drinking from some fine celadon cup. She's coming from a tiring day out in the field, and she's just really savoring the tea that she's drinking. A quintessential picture of her. And later in the chapter, I ask her how she feels about having so many weeds to cut, and with them roaring back so quickly, you cannot believe how much rain there is, and the soil is so fertile, it's just like this constant battle with weeds. And I say, don't you feel doing that year in and year out? Damn, this is a pain. I'm too tired. And she says, sure I do. But there are all kinds of disagreeable things in life, aren't there? I just think, that's my job. Otherwise, if you started thinking the way you're talking about, you don't even clean up after yourself. You think, I did that yesterday. Why do I have to do it again today? It's better to say to yourself, cut back the weeds, then the eggplants will get big, and then I'll be really happy. All right, so here's some of the red rice that they grow. This is down the valley. Her partner Yamashita-san, who has a PhD in Hindu philosophy and has published papers on the difference between the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali and different concepts of self and Atman and Brahman. He taught Meiji period literature in Tagore's university. And I talk a fair amount in the chapter about him. I really like Yamashita-san. He's such an open person, but sort of a mystery man as well. And when he comes back, he takes a job teaching elementary school while he grows rice. I'm going to pick that up a little bit. As I talk, at the beginning of each of the chapters, my publisher, I think quite wisely, suggested that I write a little paragraph about, you know, kind of introducing what are some of the questions that each of these people address, and I write here, even though there are so many wisdom teachings about humility, our daily habit is to admire people with advanced degrees or important positions. And if we ourselves have accomplished things that society recognizes as superior, we may fall prey to the all-too-human tendency to get proud. We may try to use our accomplishments as a kind of psychic safety blanket to blunt the edge of our own worries by saying, I'm established in my profession. Yet, is avoiding this anxiety the best way to make the biggest choices in our lives? So then I sort of transition to talking about doing work with your own hands. And I talked to him. He's, let me read you. So there's some extended passages I translated from different people's writings. And he's does a little newsletter. He writes articles for the newspaper. And he, this is actually a translation from one of his newspaper articles. We lived in India for more than 10 years, and there were many good things about it, especially how people took things slowly, and preparing and eating food took a long time. That was such a good feeling for us. But one of the reasons we came back to Japan is that we wanted to eat in a more principled way, to nurture our lives. We felt that it would be correct to cultivate the land ourselves. I love this quote. While surrounded on all sides by the inconvenience of countryside living, you can get a rich enjoyment of the flavor of your own humanness. So later on in the article, he talks about some principles of being four objectives for our farming. One, be lazy. Save unnecessary work. Two, be stingy. Don't spend any money. Forget about the economic system. Three, be safe. Don't use poisons on your food. Four, I love this, don't be greedy with the soil. Determine its actual fertility and don't try to get a bigger harvest than you ought by using too much fertilizer. If you understand what your soil can really produce, you have a stable harvest from year to year.
Un-American.
No. Un-American. this is the tea plantation where he does manual labor. So actually after a few years, I visited these people a couple of times. I came back and he had lost his job at the elementary school, because he had gotten sick and he couldn't work. And when he got better, he applied for it again. They wouldn't give it to him. And I said, why is that? And he says, well, I have a PhD and they'd have to pay me too much. So they hired somebody. And I said, I started getting really angry. And he's like, yeah, it's great, you know. So I said, what are you doing? And he's like, working in this tea plantation. Some guy in construction has gotten an interest in organic tea. And I know this is a tea place, so I thought I'd do a little bit of tea here. And so here's a little passage on this. It says, he shows me a viney weed that grows around the tea plant. If you don't pull this weed, he says, it gets mixed in with the tea leaves and tastes terrible. So I have to get it all out. And he adds, if I just pull the vine from the top of the plant, it snaps halfway down and grows right back. So I have to pull it down, pull it out from the roots. Think about this for a second. He squats down and reaches under the tea bush and yanks out the weed. I grimace. Looks like really hard work. And I say, I imagine if the tea is not organic, they deal with this weed with herbicides. Exactly right, he answers. So, Yamashita-san, if I'm out in the world enjoying organic green tea from Japan, somewhere there's somebody doing the squat labor of pulling this weed? He smiles an ambiguous smile and nods. I notice the incredible drama of the sky and mountains behind him. Then he says, laughing, you are drinking my sweat and my tears. It's the grapes of wrath. Exactly. Trying to put it delicately, I mentioned that it's a long distance from teaching Meiji period Japanese literature at a university. It's okay, he says. I don't mind too much, and it won't last forever. It's a kind of yoga practice. Or to say it in a Buddhist way, kind of kugyo. When I look up the word, the dictionary equivalent in English is asceticism or penance. Ku is the same character for painful or bitter. And then I say, somehow, not to him, somehow it feels not quite fair. Then I consider if we in the world want to drink organic tea, someone has to do this work, and it's pure classism on my part to think that people with a lot of education should somehow be above it. So, he's like, I'll only have to do this for 3 or 4 more years, and when my youngest daughter goes off to college, I'll be able to cut back a little bit. And it's very meditative. I love this picture because you can kind of see where he is every day. See him going to work. He's like, "Honey, I'm free. I can get there at 7 if I want to. I can leave at noon, or I can get there in the middle of the day, or leave any time I want to. No one's telling me to work."
That's on Shikoku 2.
That's on Shikoku 2. All right, here's the last person I'm going to give you an introduction to. This is Mr. Masanori Oe. He's the only person in the book. It's chapter 11. Quite a mind blower. Even the publisher said, "Wow," said that. He lived in the United States first in 1965. He's a little bit older than most of the other folks in the book. He is the first person to translate the Tibetan Book of the Dead into English. He's published over 10 books, so he's the only person who's sort of well-known in the book. And he has translated Krishnamurti, Ramana Maharshi, Milarepa, several books of Milarepa. He's published books on Aboriginal Dreamtime. He's published books on Native American spirituality. Introduced, I have some of his books here. You guys can page through them after I finish. And what he's doing is not just introducing sort of Vivaldi and Schopenhauer to Japanese readerships, but sort of more Aboriginal traditions and things usually ignored or looked down upon by Japanese society. This is his copy of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. He hand-bound it first. He and Wakako, his partner, put together 1,000 copies. And he hand-bound it. And here he's giving it to this woman. She's a poet. This is an occasion of her 88th birthday. And I found it quite poignant because, you know, this is about the, as many of you know, the journey of the soul after death. And he's giving her one of these hand-bound, one-of-a-kind copies. So let me read you a little bit of his writing here. So I said, you know, he's the first person to do the Tibetan, he's started the first health food store in all of Japan. He did the first version of the Whole Earth Catalog in Japanese. He made movies in the 60s with Timothy Leary in New York City. He writes a lot about psychedelia, and I said, "Oh, like drugs." And he's like, "Actually, the Latin root of this is psyche is the heart or soul, and delos is to open. So if you do it with drugs, that's a possible way, but there are many other ways to open the soul." So I said to him, "Have you always been so alternative?" He said, "Well, one place to start, and this is just one way to answer this question, is when I was born actually right around Pearl Harbor," he told me, "and right after the war," I'll read this directly. Get his words right. "One night before the end of the war, the city next to our town was firebombed, and the entire city, all of it, was burned, totally black. And then the airplane started coming towards our town, just to the north. I was with my mother and a crowd of people, running away, panicking, screaming, heading north toward the mountains. As I ran along, we crossed a bridge, and my foot got stuck between 2 stones in the bridge, and I couldn't pull it out. The more I panicked and struggled, the more stuck it got, and I had somehow lost hold of my mother's hand. She had my baby sister in her arms, and somehow in the chaos, she didn't notice that I wasn't still with her. All of a sudden, all the other people were far ahead of me, and I was by myself, and a B-29 bomber was coming upon me from behind. Everyone in the crowd was far away. And the reality of death was thrust right at me. Machine guns from the plane were strafing the ground. Rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a. Until that moment, I had always been with my mother. It was just one world. I hadn't woken up to the idea of a self. I suddenly understood that I was alone. In fact, that was when I understood that I existed, In that very instant, I realized I am, that I existed separately from others. At the same instant that I realized that death is, I realized that I could die. For most people, this happens gradually. They become aware of an ego and they separate from their parents. But for me, it was sudden. The city was charred jet black and the airplane was firing at me. This question of death overwhelmed me. From the time, that time, I had a real terror of it. When I look back at this now, I see that that was a starting point on my journey. To the very degree that I couldn't get clear about this issue of death, I would be unable to see what, for me, was life. Since then, I was pursuing the question, doko kara doko e, where from, where to. Japanese sentences often leave the subject implied, so I ask him whether he means where he as an individual came from and is going, or whether he means the question in terms of humanity or the cosmos as a whole. His answer shifts everything. In the Eastern conception of things, the large external universe and the universe inside each person are not separate. They are the same. Thus, the dreams that humans see are actually also the dreams of the universe. I don't feel that a human's origin and destiny are different from that of the universe as a whole. So, through the chapter, I follow his journey. This is the house that they built, he and his partner, out of mud and straw, and it's a sort of a learning center for people in the community. It's I love this window here. This is not a window to let light in from the outside world. This is a window to let art from the inside of the house out. And this is, can you see there's sort of a circle here? It's one of his ways of welcoming visitors is to have a circle of water to remind us of the circle of life. And they left this wall unfinished to show people how it's done. So almost everything that he and his partner do is an invitation to the community. This photo is of two twin boys. Both of them were sort of misfits and perhaps somewhat learning disabled. And oops, I'm on reserve power. Looks like we're going to have to end this soon. And this is, let me finish this up. Finish one thing, Andy. And so he started a school, and maybe we should get some power here. So I'm going to rush this here.
Great God of technology,
don't leave me now. There's a couple people in this book that would be laughing at me right now, so you can join them if you wish. So he runs a school with some of the other members of the community for some of the misfits kids, as they call them, who don't work in the status-oriented system of Japan. These are some of his woodblock prints. Does anyone know the story of Jumping Mouse? It's a great Native American story. So here's this person who's like telling stories of Zen Buddhism or Krishnamurti as well as Native American stories. This is some of his woodblocks in a hand-bound book. It's a great story. I definitely recommend it to you. This is great. And we're here in his rice paddy. And he says to me, it's a grain of rice. He says, if you plant one grain of rice in the ground and let it grow, you'll have 10 stalks. And out of each stalk, you'll get about 100 grains of rice. So from one single grain of rice, you get about 1,000 grains of rice. That's much better than putting money in a bank. So,
my birthday.
Yes. This is a little Scheherazade-ish, perhaps, of me, but he does start to grapple throughout the chapter with this question of life and death. But if I had to shorten it too much and kind of put it into a soundbite for you, I think it would be a bit of a not quite fair to it, so I'll recommend you to the book to read it. I'm going to give you just a quick quick, without reading anything, just a couple of the other people in the book. This is Mr. Osamu Nakamura. He is a woodblock carver. He lives perhaps most simply of everybody in the book. He has no telephone, no car. He lived in Nepal for 10 years in the mountains with Sherpa villagers. These are some of his woodblocks. It's chapter 2. This is very different person, Mrs. Jinko Kaneko. She's a fine artist. She's a painter as well as a fabric artist. You'll see one of her hangings over there, and there's another one that I can hand around later. This is her work. We weren't able to put many color photos in the book, so it's all very realistic, yet somehow she sort of captured the mystery of the natural world in it. I attempt to get at that in the chapter. This is a close-up of the hangings. Does anyone know what this is? What material this is? Felt. Look at the detail she gets in the felt. Sorry, can you see there? Yeah. This is Mr. Akira Ito. He's right in the middle of the book. He's one of the elders for the people in the book. He's a children's book illustrator. There's a lot of his poetry. He's a writer. Although he started as a petroleum engineer. And he's also, this is a picture from one of his essays where he's explaining how he has mixed yoga philosophy, Chinese I Ching philosophy, and theoretical astrophysics to try to come up with a theory of all energy and matter in the universe. And here he is picking some awabancha. Has anyone heard of awabancha? Not just bancha, awabancha. I think it's rather unlikely. It's only grown in three valleys in all of Japan. Most people outside of this area have never heard of it. Here he is preparing it. And I've actually brought some this evening. So
Is it tea?
It's tea, yeah, sorry. It's fermented tea. It's got like a little bit of a lemony, sour flavor. And if people would like to stick around afterwards, the hosts here have kindly offered to do a little tea tasting with it. So this is Ito-san's drawings of how to make awabancha. And this is where they're abrading the leaves. And it's done in the middle of the summer and packed into barrels. This is another person. This is Mr. San Oizumi. He's an anarchist, a potter, an anti-nuclear activist. This is his work, and he's quite a wry character. And this is his kiln of a Korean style. It's all done with firewood. This is Masanori's partner, Wakako. She is a puppet maker and a calligrapher. An environmental installation artist, although I'm sure she would wince if I described her that way. And she's also a mentor to some of the women in the surrounding villages on her particular style of no cultivation farming. This is some of the mugwort she gathers. This is some of her calligraphy. This is some of her food, and really delicious. And this is one of her paintings, which she's never trained as an artist. She said she just gets sound and moves the paintbrush as if she were dancing to the music. And I said, so what kind of music? She's like, any kind of music that people give me, you know, Kate Bush or this other one, that, what do you call the minimal ongaku, minimal music. I said, what do you mean? So this one I did to that man, what was his name? Eno. I said, Brian Eno? Oh, that was his name. So I like to tell that story because they are living in some ways traditional, but they're not living in the 12th century at all, and they've really made a great life for themselves. Okay, I think I am going to finish with the road forward for me, perhaps, and for you. And I will take some questions, and thank you very much.
So
if you like, we can start brewing some tea and then distribute it for anyone who would like while you take a few questions.
Okay.
I'm also going to mention that when people do decide to leave, there's a donation bowl over here on the counter. And with the Buddhist custom of dana, or giving, we share the proceeds of that bowl with our speakers for their his work.
Thank you. And, it's the first time that has ever happened in my reading.
we're unusual even for an independent bookstore. And the other half is retained by us to help maintain this space and keep it going. So the tea will start working on here, and in the meantime, please ask any questions. Great. Thank you so much, by the way, for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Hopefully I've just teased you and have not satisfied your hunger.
Exactly.
Oh, and before I get questions, let me just say one word about the state of publishing today. I think you all have heard that, you know, books are on their way out. Nobody reads them anymore. I'm depending on you to prove that wrong. I made a little sheet. So if you feel like this is a good message or you want to recommend it to your friends, there's a little list of things you can do and a little short description of it. So talking to your friends, actually telling them, but if you're sort of, you know, networked, you can, these are some suggestions you can do. And if you'd like to write a little review of the book, of course, buy it at an independent bookstore, but some people are not so blessed to have one near them in rural Arkansas. You can write a little review on Amazon, but I didn't say that. And there's a couple more readings I'm having. There are on the blog. Number ones that I haven't put on this, I'm going to be reading in New York, so if you have friends in New York, I'm going to be reading at East West Books in Mountain View on Tuesday the 27th, and at Gateways in Santa Cruz on the 29th. So if you know someone you want to tell about the readings, and there's on the back, there's the blog. You can ask me questions there as well, and I will answer some of them. Okay, enough talking for Andy. You guys have questions? Yes.
Yeah, two questions. They're not related, unfortunately. The first question I have is, and answer this part of it more briefly. Did you use a tape recorder to?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
A tape recorder, a mini disc recorder, an iPod recorder, it's like different ones. Yes, and I listened to them again and again and again and again. Except for Mr. Nakamoto in Chapter 2, he refused.
Okay.
And it might be better for that. Who knows?
The second question was, how did you come to meet the people you decided to put in the book? And of the 10 people you met, how many made it into the book?
Atsuko, who you met first, I met at an Earth Day event, actually 20 years ago, and she invited me up, and then through her network I started to meet people. Not everybody in the book knows each other, but a lot of them lived together in Kathmandu in the late 70s and early 80s. And I originally had 22 articles in the Japan Times series, 22 different people, and of that I chose 11. There's a lot of people doing alternative things in different ways in Japan, and I just chose ones that I thought were different from each other, tried to get a mix of men and women, tried to get a mix of people. So always use the internet. Nakamoto-san doesn't even have a telephone. So I wanted to get a variety. Looks like you had a question? Someone like this? No?
Yeah, I think
It's sort of related to that, but when you met them, did you have a book in you? Did you just have a book?
When I very first met them, I just was there teaching English, and I was intending to buy some property in California, and I thought I'd work in Japan because pay was good, and I knew it was a very conservative country, but teaching English isn't necessarily a bad thing. And then I met these people, and I got, as my Japanese got better, so I had this Indian food with them, and then their philosophy was amazing. I thought, nobody knows about this. So I got more and more drawn into it.
And so then you would go back with tape recorder with
a
one mind. So in the beginning it was simply you on your own kind of people.
Yeah. Don't be shocked. Yeah, you have another question?
How did they all come to wind up being in India and Kathmandu?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of them wanted to leave Japan, didn't find what they needed there, and didn't want to go to Europe, weren't oriented towards that. And as they traveled, there was sort of a network of Japanese travelers, and they found out about, you can read about this in the book I detailed, there's a then monk who had rejected his father and his grandfather's profession of being an abbot at a temple, and he went to Nepal, and he got interested in Nepali Buddhism, which is different than Nepali Hinduism, which is different from Tibetan Buddhism, and he started doing documentation work, and he did this whole cultural preservation project, which is amazing in itself, and then he had a lodge, so Japanese people could live there, and then they all got involved in this cultural preservation project, so they ended up getting to know each other, and they formed these bonds that have lasted to this day. It's a very short version of it.
Can we see some of the other art?
Yes, good. All right, so thank you. So this is one of the hangings here tonight. This is by a woman named Ms. Noda. She's not in the book, but she's one of the people who wrote in the article. This is 150 years old, and she's like remade. So this is a... So she, not remade, she added things to it, but you can actually sort of feel the age on this garden ornament. This is just a small batik work of Amemiya-san. Bye.
Thank you very much.
Bye, Dee Dee. Thanks for the map.
Thank you.
Mr. Ito is a children's book illustrator, and this is one of his books here. This is one of Mr. Oe-san's books in Japanese. I forgot to let people know that I have another book. This is my first book on writing. I'm a writing teacher. Who forgets to say that? You can take a look at it and perhaps order it here. I should have been better. And,
sorry, I wasn't writing. I was writing the book. Yeah. I thought this was your first.
Yeah, and these I'd like to ask you to handle gently. These are some of the original woodblock prints by Mr. Osamu Nakamura. So perhaps as you're drinking tea, you might want to handle it with a different hand. Maybe I'll put this here, and you can look through those.
Very nice tea.
Very interesting. I could use a little bit of that.
It tastes very Japanese.
Yeah. Most Japanese people won't know about this tea. Here. There we go. Any other questions? Well, I'd be happy to sign books and chat with people afterwards. Thanks so much for coming out.
The gentleman who had the water circle in his...
Yes.
Was that supposed to be an Enso?
Yep. You know that word.
I know the word.
Yes.
That's actually, I know it means circle.
That's his email address. Ichi Enso.
Is this or... It's backwards. Or...
Mm.
In the reverse direction. Yeah.